first, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 24th, 2002, and I am from the Midtown group. It has been my home group for a little over 5 years now, which means that when I have 5 years, I'll actually have been in my home group for like 5.5 years. It took me a while. It took me 2.5 years to get sober, and in and out of the rooms of AA, I can't say if I was actually in them emotionally or spiritually, but I was in them, which basically means is I was stealing somebody else's chair. I was very selfish and very self-centered. I needed a lot of attention, which you'll hear in my story, absolutely. When I say I'm alcoholic, I'm fully admitting to you guys that I know I'm a thief, a con, and a liar, and you'll hear that too, you know. Alternative substances are part of my story. I know that this is an AA meeting, but there may be some mention of some other things besides alcohol, but I'll tell you what, I know that those things that I took allowed me to drink the way that I wanted to, and that's the only reason why I use them. Not because I thought that they were glamorous, but because I really felt like I needed to in order to drink the way I wanted to. So I'll just go ahead and tell you what I was like. You know, I grew up in the ghettos of Georgetown in Washington, D.C., in a small little neighborhood called Burleith at 36 and S. I did live in the suburbs for a little while after my parents got divorced, and then we moved back into the city. I went to Catholic school from 2nd to 8th grade, and then I went on to a boarding school and down on Route 17 called St. Margaret's, and I was there for 2 years, and all these wonderful things happened to me in between. You know, I'm the youngest of five of an Irish Catholic family. I am Irish Italian, so that means that I have a wonderful temperament. I'm extremely patient and kind. And really what it means is that I have a really charming personality at times, and then at other times I'm just not so nice, you know, and I run out of patience, and I, as an alcoholic, I've found out that all of the rationalizations and delusion that I was under was only fired more up by my upbringing, which was basically like, as long as everything looks good from the outside, you know, everything is okay on the inside. And that was not the case for me. But I played along so much that throughout school, I started out training for the Junior Olympics when I was from ages 5 till 8 in swimming. I was an extremely talented swimmer when I was a child, but I broke my arm in a roller skating incident, and I went roller skating every Saturday night at Jell-O Boys and Girls Club in Georgetown, and I thought I was real hot one night, and I fell on my ass and somebody roller skated over my arm. So my swimming career was put on hold, and then when I went back to swimming, my coaches tried to coach me, and I didn't like that, you know. You ain't shit, Marissa, you ain't shit, you know, come on, come on, come on. And I said, you're yelling at me, how dare you yell at me, you know. And I would basically turn over to field sports at that point, and I played soccer from then on in. And up until I ruined my knees, you know. But I did everything I could to look good on the outside. So I went to art classes on the weekends. I was on the soccer team. I think I was pretty good. I made varsity my freshman year of high school, so I was pretty good. I won a lot of awards. They called me most talented in my yearbook at Catholic school, you know. And the reality was is I was, like, the most sensitive of my friends. I was the most hardworking, only to hide what I was doing. The reality was that I took my first drink when I was 8 years old. I found a bottle of scotch above my mom's refrigerator, and I waited for a little while to pull. That's what I do. I'm a poller. I ask the same question over and over again until I get the answer I want, you know, and I'm still guilty of that. You know, going outside the sponsor, I'll go to you know, my pigeon sisters or everybody else, to, and I keep getting the same answer, and I'm saying, how fair is this? No one will co-sign my shit. It's so fucked up. But anyway, it just means I'm surrounded by great people, you know. It just means I'm surrounded by great people. My home group is very large. I'm sure that you have heard of the Midtown group, and there are about 300 to 350 of us, and, you know, on any given night, you'll find that we are together, you know, and that's an awesome thing about having a home group. Anyway, that was a little bit like what my friends were like when I was growing up, you know. I felt different then, like a lot of people, you know, but I felt like not so far apart from the kids that also had parents that worked. So we could run the streets, you know, in the afternoons and stuff like that. I would go down to Commander Salamir in Georgetown, and I would get my hair spray painted green and put on this, like, Pat Benatar makeup and Madonna clothes, and would come home, like, all messed up. No one was home to see that I looked like that or did anything like that. And that was, like, 6, 7 years old, guys. And, so at 8 years old, I was ready to be somebody else, is the reality of the deal. My parents got divorced when I was 3, so my dad was ready to be somebody else, and he got remarried that year. And also, that was one of the years the cicadas came out really bad in D.C., and so that was stressful. And and really it was, because I had this one boy pull off the wings of one and eat it. He was from, I come from D.C., it's a very international place, and at my private school there were a lot of diplomats' kids and stuff like that. So I was around a lot of international people, which was to my advantage as an alcoholic, because come to find out, you know, my best friend from Argentina's family had a full wine cellar in their townhouse in DuPont Circle, and we would go down there and we would drink, and we would drink the leftovers at the parties, and we would drink at the parties, and nobody cared. Nobody said anything, because that's the way they do it in their country. And she's fine. She's not alcoholic, and she would try and keep up with me, and she would bow out, you know, and I'd be like, more for me, all right. But at 8 years old, I found this bottle of scotch, and I finally pulled my dad, and I said, why do you drink? You know, and he said, it calms me down. You know, I'm a lawyer. I am developing a lot in Northern Virginia, and there's just a lot of stress. And I'm like, oh, poor dad, you know. And I felt like I had a lot of stress. He just got remarried. My mom started acting strange. She had bipolar, and she would hide in her room from time to time. Or I would come home, and the furniture would be completely rearranged. You just never knew what you would come home to. She didn't drink. I'm 8 years old, 9 years old at this time, and she's getting kind of weird, and my grandmother's getting kind of weird. When I was a kid, I used to go and visit my grandparents up in Annapolis, and we would go sailing, and I grew up on the Chesapeake Bay, vacationing with them more and more often, and I didn't know what was going on in my home, and nor did I really care. You know, I was pretty involved with what I was up to, you know, and so, but my grandmother was very close to me. She was like a second mother. And as time went on, she was acting a little weird. I would go down to Naples, Florida, where they had moved, and I would vacation with them from month to month to a time. And the last time I saw her, I was 12 years old, and I was in the 8th grade, and I was already drinking. And they were having their gin and tonics, and I would just stare at the beads on the glass, just like the beads of water that just condensation dripping, and it was like this water torture for me, because I would go a whole month without smoking any pot or drinking or anything, and it was just torture, you know. And I would try and sneak their alcohol, but more often than not, you know, they were pretty fast drinkers, you know, both Irish, and so I didn't really get to do a whole lot in front of them, and so my relationship with her got strained that year. And I thought it was all my fault when I found out the last day of my confirmation service, and it was, you know, we were going to have the confirmation the next Sunday. I got a phone call from my sister, who was coming to pick me up instead of my mom, and she said, Mom gone to Florida. And I said, how'd she do it? And I knew my grandmother had hung herself in the carport, and I knew there was something wrong. And that's what I said to her. And she said, how did you know? And I said, you know, last summer things were weird. And she was using a lot of benzodiazepines, which we know is just dry martinis, you know. And so that shocked me, you know. It threw me. And at that point I said, okay, fine, you know, right, wrong, indifferent. I don't care anymore. Because the one person I was being good for was her. Because my mom wasn't really around. I mean, she worked very hard to get where she finally got to. But I always wanted to impress my grandmother. She was the etiquette type of woman, pearls, white gloves, Episcopalian from Pittsburgh, you know, and I wanted to impress her. She gave me my first box of very expensive stationery when I was 8 years old, and now I work for that company, and it's really weird. But the deal was I couldn't stand being in that house anymore, and I was going down the wrong path. I was already drinking, as I said before, and you would think an eight-year-old doesn't drink that often, but the friends that I had, I was drinking about twice a week, at eight, nine, three times a week, 10, four times a week, 11, 12, pretty much, same deal, and I had found some mind-altering substances at 12 years old when I was in the 8th grade, and I decided that I was going to go to boarding school. I was supposed to go to an all-girls Catholic school in Georgetown, but I asked my mom, can I go to this boarding school? It's got a great art program. And really, the reality was I just wanted to get away from her. She was crazy. I wanted to get away from me because I was crazy. I wanted to get away from my friends because it was their fault I was crazy, because they're bad influences, and they run fast, and they, you know, whatever. The reality was is my mom just believed, I work hard and I play hard. This is a reward. Here's your child support money. Go to boarding school. And I went, and she went, you know, because all my sisters were in college, and she could be not on medication for her disease, and she could go and be whoever she wanted to be. And she did that while I was in boarding school, and we were not very sure what that was about because no one was watching her. So I came home to some funny stuff, but what happened was in boarding school, I was on varsity soccer, and I was making all of these excuses as to why I got to drink with the townie boys and got to hang out with them, and why I ended up dealing my soccer teammates and the lacrosse girls cocaine and speed. And I'm 13, 14 years old in Tappahannock, Virginia, and I'm slinging coke. Well, I might as well go home then, because if I'm going to be like that, you know, I might as well go to D.C. And so I did, and I also had met the one at that point. When you're in high school, there's always going to be that one boy, you know, and I'm speaking to everybody as if that happens to everybody, and sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it doesn't, but it happened to me. And he had a bright orange hair, and he went to an alternative high school, and I thought he was the greatest thing in the whole world, and so I came home, and I went to an alternative high school in DuPont Circle that really didn't have to do much to get in there. You just had to have money. But the reality was is that it ended up being a good deal for me, because what happened was at 16 years old, I got early acceptance into the number one art school in the country at the time, 1994. I had been going to the Corcoran the whole time. While I was in grade school and high school and stuff when I was home during the holidays. And so from the outside, yet again, everything looks great. Marissa works hard. She plays hard. I would be able to bring beer home. I would be able to have my friends over when my mom had gone and sought out her education. She would go out of town, and I would have parties in the house. And my mom would say, that's fine because the house is cleaner when I come home than when I left. And so, you know, it was fine. I mean, we would smoke in the house. We would have pony kegs, you know, cases upon cases, beer. And as you can see, I have tattoos and piercings. And so some of the people that I hung out with were of the fighting variety. And I have a lot of violence in my story as well. So if I were to speed ahead, I could tell you that I went to Providence, and I took one semester in that school, and I failed out because I brought beer with me in my suitcase. I was drunk the day I got there. I found the kids that fit my profile at the time. I'm a chameleon, so whatever type of punk rocker you are, you know, whether you're a mod or a Rudy or a skinhead or whatever, I could fit in. I had all the outfits. I had all the haircuts. I had all the hair dye, you know, and the proper piercings, and I started getting tattooed before I left D.C., and so I was, you know, moving along in this kind of culture that I was living in, and it was cool because a lot of these kids came from the same kind of background I did, you know, parents who worked really hard and from working class to middle class and had, and classes were very important in the 80s in D.C. It was obviously separate, not so much today. Or I don't see it as much, but I did as a kid, and it affected me. It affected me a lot. The end of the Cold War affected me a lot because I am the youngest of five, so my sisters were still totally paranoid, and I was hanging out with kids from all over the world, and I didn't care, if your parents were socialists or communists or whatever, but being red was still a big deal back then, and I was like, who cares? You know, like, my friends drink the way that I want to drink. They party the way that I want to party. I don't care what they believe in. I don't care what their right and wrong is. And so I hung out with a lot of people who had a lot of hate in their heart and a lot of violence, and they were very disturbed people. And I was used to that, you know, and going to art school, I got to express a lot of that. And I got a lot of recognition for my talent and my anger and how versatile, you know, my opinions were. And of course they were versatile because I had all these pigeonholes to fit myself into. And I had lots of groups of friends. And I was making amends to this girl I grew up with, the Argentinian girl. And she said, if it weren't for you, I wouldn't have had a social life in high school. If it weren't for your alcoholism, I would have never known where the party was. And I said, Christina, you're crazy, you know? Like, the kind of partying I brought that girl to and the kind of things and people I introduced her to, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing because I wouldn't wish that on anybody, you know? And I had to apologize to her for that. And she sees nothing wrong with it because it helps her. She's a discharge counselor at a psych ward, so it helps her. She works with schizophrenics. I said, you get any alcoholics in there? She's like, I don't know, you know. It's just funny. So she probably had a lot of experience with the kind of things that I was up to by the end of my drinking. So I transferred. I left Rhode Island. I met a one up there, you know, and I moved in with him, and I lived in Rhode Island for the rest of that year. And I went through one winter up there, and I couldn't deal. You know, I'm from the swamp of D.C., you know, and it's really cold up north, and even though my family's from the north, I couldn't hack it, and I couldn't hack the bravado, and I couldn't, because I was starting to get more and more sensitive and more dependent on alcohol. I definitely had the shakes by 17, 18 years old, and the story goes on, you know, could have stopped there, but no. So then I went to Richmond. I lived there 5 years. I started, again, I'm a great starter, you know, it's like that third step, you know, it's like one, two, okay, third step, okay, and you start starting, and then you're like, yeah, you know what, I'm just going to hang out, I'm just going to lay back, this four-step thing seems like a little too big of a deal, I'm just going to, and then next thing you know, I'd be drunk again, you know, 2.5 years I did that, and I went to Richmond, and by the fifth year I was there, my teacher said, either you got to quit drinking, or you got to get out. I was getting kicked out of a state school. I mean, that's kind of hard to do. And, well, not so hard. But, I mean, for people like us, it's not so hard. But I couldn't deal with that, you know. And I'm a hostage taker, you know. I've mentioned a couple boyfriends already, the ones. And really, it was just like, they'd put up with me because I was, you know, a charmer. And I was able to, I was able to make them believe that I was the greatest thing that ever happened to them because I was high up on this social scene, this ladder that I thought I was great example of what it looks like in the magazines to be these types. And I played the part really well. You know, I'm a great actor. That's something that is in common with a lot of us. And so I... I was in Richmond, and I had left art school because I wasn't going to stop drinking. I had a hostage. His name was David. And here comes in my first anecdote of, my delusion. I thought that I was so smart because I'm very overeducated, and I don't know about my common sense, but I know I have some street smarts. But I was going to write a manifesto about it, and we were going to get married, and I was going to live over in Roanoke, and I was going to have a goat, and we were going to grow our own food, and I'm a city girl, so that didn't work out very well, especially when you said it's Jack Daniels or me. And I like Jack a whole lot more than David, Jack's a nice guy. And so, and what's funny is that he called my family looking for me a few years ago saying he was having trouble getting sober, And it broke my heart to tell him that AA is in the phone book. There's nothing I can do for you. Because there really wasn't. There really wasn't anything I could do for him, because the reality was is that I could hold the hand of people I care about, but what kind of friend would I be if I did that, And in Richmond, I did go to an AA meeting. It was my first AA meeting, although I had been to ACOA meetings while I was in boarding school, because you got to smoke at them and drink coffee, and they loved me because I was young, full of spirit, and so honest, and I thought that my dad had a drinking problem, my mom told me my dad had a drinking problem. What I didn't realize is that's really none of my business in AA, you can't 12-step your family, you can't 12-step, your best friends. You got to hand them over to people who are just as good at 12-stepping as you are, and if you stay around here and you watch people, you get to know who those people are. You hang out with the winners and you hand them over to people who care, because I come from such a great, huge home group that's tons and tons of people, and so I have handed over my friends to a lot of very responsible individuals, and I thank them for it all the time. And back to David in Richmond and Roanoke, I didn't write my manifesto. I didn't marry David. I ended up holed up in a apartment in Richmond where I think I was inside when they tacked up the eviction notice. I'm not really sure. I didn't hear it. But I was shaking so bad I couldn't hold a drink anymore. I could barely zip up my pants or put my pants down or anything. So when that happens, you get pretty dirty. And I guess that's the nicest way of putting it. And so one morning I woke up and I went down to the corner bar because I couldn't even take my pants off to go to the bathroom. I had to get my shakes to stop first. And bar tab had been running on my credit card since the night before, and I didn't care. I said, give me doubles, I want them now, and a straw. And so I had four doubles of Jack Daniels set up in front of me in Richmond. Sometimes they don't really care. They just, they want you fixed and out of their bar. And if it's 8 o'clock in the morning, they want you fixed and out of their bar, And so I took those down, and the shakes finally stopped. And I went over to my friend's house because we had plans to watch soap operas and drink. And because that was my life. And, I had drinking games for the soap operas. And, I would gain like $2 in change from my friends' sofas and stuff like that. I would go change diving in my friends' furniture, and I would get a 40, and I would be waiting, pacing the 7-Eleven at 6 o'clock in the morning down in Richmond on Grace Street. I would just pace. I would just pace, and I would wait till 6. I could have gone inside and paced in there, but I'd be too embarrassed. But I'd see the clock from outside, just watch. 6 o'clock in the morning, I would get that 40, and I would be like, And Clancy calls it a coil that tightens. Other people call it, I just call it an undigestible ball of pain, because at that time I had been drinking over 10 years, and I felt like I'm never going to be good enough. I'm never going to amount to anything, and I might as well do this until I die. I don't care when it is. It could be tomorrow, could be 10 years from now, could be 100 years from now. I don't care. I'm going to do this for the rest of my life because this is all I know. I couldn't trust anybody. I didn't have any friends. I did go to one AA meeting where my friend Valerie D goes. She's an awesome person. It's called the Jaywalkers Group. down in Richmond. If you get a chance, you should go there. I went to one meeting there, and I saw all of them, and I was like, oh, too happy. Can't deal with that. I'm out. One meeting, I'm out, you know. And so then I came home. I went to, I finally called my mom, and I said, I can't stop drinking. I need help. And she came. Good Al-Anon. You know, she came. And 2 weeks later, I was back on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and I was hanging out on the docks with the boys, pretending I was about to go sailing, but really just getting drunk, you know, and I couldn't even get on a boat. I couldn't even lift a sail. I was shaking all the time, and I was losing the lining of my stomach all the time. I'm still paying for that because I have no enamel on my teeth, you know, and I was already addicted to some alternative substances, so I was trying to take the edge off in any way I could with, like, you know, trucker speed and lots of coffee and Benadryl and, I mean, anything I could get my hands on. And, you know, drinking NyQuil, mouthwash, I mean, you name it. And I never did the vanilla extract or anything like that. I always could get my hands on something better than that. And so that actually made me better than some people in my delusional mind when I got here. But at the same time, I had eventually worked up to get a job at the National Gallery of Art. And this is where the what happened starts. And it's just a series of institutions and homes and psych wards and crack addiction and prostitution. And it's a sad, sad thing. And I'm glad that what happened at the end knocked so much out of me that I don't have a lot of emotional attachment to that kind of stuff, because it's very hard to talk about. But I will, you know. If it'll help somebody, I'll do whatever I can. I'll do whatever I can. I will tell you whatever you need to hear about my story, if it's part of your story. I have 17 years of drinking experience and using experience. I have 2.5 years of relapse. I don't think I don't call it relapse either. I mean, they told me that in rehab, but I mean, the reality was I just didn't stop drinking, and I took up somebody else's chair in AA, you know, and I wasted people's time, and I offended people, and I used a lot of cuss words, and I didn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people, but I made sense to me, you know, and it made sense, you know. So at, let's see, my mom found me in DuPont Circle drunk. I had run away from my job and from her house and took another hostage in Adams Morgan. So May 10th of 2001, I went to my first detox at Suburban Hospital. And then I went to go live with my sister and started Arlington Hospital's outpatient. And then I went to go, I relapsed, or drank again, and I went and lived at the Arlington Hospital, or the Arlington Women's Home, and then I got kicked out of there for drinking. In 35 days, I got kicked out of there, you know, and they give you a half an hour to move out, and they threw me into the emergency room, a bit banana bagged again, you know, and it was a series of banana bags as well, because I was really, really sick, you know, and, so eventually I got enough of my stuff together that I got an apartment in D.C. in the neighborhood I grew up in, Princess again, you know, and I could go out that one last time. I was still in outpatient program in Arlington Hospital, and just one last time. I forgot to mention, and my good friend Mike would be upset if I didn't mention, that I went to therapy when I had moved in with my mom, and I got put on some medications, and I was told that I was a victim of benign neglect, which means that you need so much goddamn attention, you know, nobody could ever keep up. But Mike loved it when I would say that, and so I'm going to say it now in his memory, you know. I was a victim of benign neglect, and I said, I knew it, I'm a victim, I knew it, you know, and he loved that about me, is that I'm one of those people that just tells you how it is. And so how it was for me is I thought that I could go out one last time, and I went down to the neighborhood I knew best, DuPont Circle, and hung out with all the gay guys, and hung out with my drug dealers, and I got a 40 for the bus ride down there, and I knew that I was going to get what I wanted when I got down there. And what I found was something happened where I was hit from behind. I was thrown down a set of stairs and dragged through the park, being beaten the whole way. I was dumped in Rock Creek with just a shirt on in December. When they found me, I had a 0.43 blood alcohol content, which was 20 and a half hours after the assault apparently happened. There were two of them. I remember nothing. All I remember is that I woke up 9 days later, and I went into 9.5 hours of reconstructive surgery. I assure you that half of my face is fake. All of this is reconstructed. And my jaw was wired shut, and I had a lot of brain trauma, so I would say things that were really, really not nice to my nurses and my parents and about my my uncle and it was just crazy. And meanwhile, I didn't know. I was on a morphine drip for the first few weeks, and so I thought that I was in heaven half the time. I thought I was dead. There were people, again, Irish Catholic, there were people in my room saying novenas and rosaries, and I had priests coming in and anointing of the sick. I mean, they really didn't know if I was going to die because I ended up developing blood clots. I had a fever of 105 for 3 days. It was completely delusional. I was fighting everybody. They had to strap me down to a bed. I had people, one of my roommates from college from Richmond came in, and I looked at her with such malice and spite that she just grabbed my hand and she said, "I'm going to pray for you anyway, even though you look like you hate me." And I blamed her for a lot of stuff that happened to me in Richmond. And so she left, and I didn't even know she was there. I found out when I made amends to her a year ago, you know. And so I felt as though the world owed me, you know. And then I survived it, you know. And I got out, and I got the wires taken off my jaw, and I sat in my dad's basement, which we came to nickname the isolation tank. It had air conditioning and cable. It was a great place. And so the wires came off, and St. Patrick's Day came around. And what else would you do on St. Patrick's Day but go see your friends in D.C.? You know, and that's what I did. But somewhere between the metro stop and my friend's house, I stopped in for a drink, just one, just so that I could feel right, just so I could get right. And so that I could be the charming, wonderful, powerful, you know, Marissa, you know. But I had just come out of the hospital. I was 112 pounds. And I had scars everywhere. And so they found me drunk on a corner, and they called my dad, and I got sent right back to Northern Virginia. And so I started marathoning meetings at an AA club in Falls Church. And then I ended up working there. And because they were just sick of me telling them how to make their coffee drinks, and because I knew better. But during that time, you know, I was on some psych meds, and I was on Depakote because of the seizures from the brain trauma, and I was on all this other stuff, and I was picking up a bottle of Trucker Speed every day, and I was drinking shots and shots and shots of espresso, and then 11 o'clock would come around, and the itch would start, and my dad would be asleep, and I could sneak out of the house. I could run up to Pimmin Hills to the 7-Eleven and grab a 40. And that's what I did, you know, because I didn't know how to cope. I didn't know about what you do here in AA. And so what happened was I was in the smoking room. I was telling everybody how they should live their lives like I usually do. And I was putting out a cigarette when I looked up, and there was a kid who looked at me and knew that I needed to go to a real AA meeting. Not that that club doesn't have real AA meetings. Don't get me wrong. But I had so very little idea of what was going on here. And I needed literally a kindergarten to go to. And that's what my home group is, really, for new people. It's like AA kindergarten. And they walk you through carefully and with so much patience and tolerance and love and amazing amount of love. And I didn't know what to do with that. I got crazy, you know, like God, get away from me. All these people are around me, you know, and they're just doing what they do, smoking cigarettes, milling around, talking to each other, just having no idea that I'm there, you know, so I had to make sure they were there. Get away from me. Get out of my way. I'm coming through. Don't make me burn you. And then they'd be like, yeah, you may want to calm down. And I'd say, that'd only be pertinent if I asked your opinion. And then they would be like, this girl's so mean. I mean, I scared people, you know. And but there was one girl who wasn't scared of me, and that was my sponsor. You know, I had had a sponsor before that. I had a resentment towards her because she ended up, when she was drinking, sleeping with my high school, the one that I talked about earlier, in a blackout. And so I was resentful at her for that from years ago. So I was like, I'm going to go sponsor her, and I'm going to make her life a living hell. It's going to be awesome. And what happened was she really just didn't care because I was just a pain in the ass is what I was. I was argumentative, and I, you know, I never called her. I didn't do anything that you're supposed to do. And so, and I had no idea what being sponsored was about. And so, of course, I wasn't helping anybody else. I was just helping myself. And so, of course, I drank again, you know, and I drank again, and I drank again. And I yelled at people, and I scared them away. And then there were just the select few that weren't scared of me. And that was Mike and Barbara and Ivy and Alice and Lori. And they are all my pigeon family, you know, today. And and I love them dearly. And it was funny because my first sponsor went to Europe, and she had me talk to Ivy. And I was like, I don't want this one. You know, like, I just don't want this one. Why are you doing this to me? And the reality was is that I would just call her when I felt like it. And then one day she called me and she said, so are you going to do this or what? And I said, what do you mean? She goes, well, you know, you've been calling me, and Dre has been back from Europe for a while, and you're not calling her at all. So what we do here is we ask people to sponsor us. And I was like, all right, will you be my sponsor? And she goes, do you follow direction? And I was like, sure. Just like, do you, are you willing to do anything to stay sober? Will you go to any lengths? I said, I'm pretty desperate, you know, I'm going to die. And she said, okay, well, you know, I'll do the best I can with you. And at the time she was pregnant, and things were hard for her, and I was on my way into rehab because there was no way in hell that I was going to stay sober without being taken away. And I got off my medication at a time before I went to rehab, and then I went a little crazy. I drank again. And at the end of a 10-day binge, I decided that I was going to hang myself because I couldn't live sober and I couldn't live drunk. Another funny story. Alice loves this one. I went down to the park where I got the crap beaten out of me in. And I decided that I can't live sober, I can't live drunk, I come from a long line of suicide, I'm just going to hang myself. But coming off of a 10-day binge, I forgot how to make a proper noose, and I made a slipknot instead. I fell out of a tree, I smacked my ass on a rock, and I've actually been sober ever since then. So, my sobriety date is actually a week after that because I don't believe in making your sobriety date before detox medications. I believe that detox medications are just as good as alcohol, and that's why they put you on it. And so that's what I was on. I was on Librium, and I went into detox after that. And so October 24th, I decided I was going to be a member of AA, and I got a first step. And I thought to myself, I don't know what this we is all about, but I know that I am completely powerless over alcohol. There was nothing stopping me, ever, you know, and until, like it says in the book, you know, until I enriched my spiritual life. And I had been Catholic, and I had a God of my understanding, but I thought that the best thing I could do for a third step was turn my will and my life over to this rehab in Chantilly, and that was the best I could do. And Ivy was fine with that. She thought, okay, well, we'll deal with it when you get out. And four steps later, we got all the truth out. And because I wasn't capable of knowing everything, because there was just a lot, you know, including some outside issues, you know, and I had to do a four step for that too. And I'm willing to do that today, you know, like I've got to do whatever it is that I'm told to do. Is it, the reality is that I'm over 21. I can get a drink wherever I want. And on a bad day, and I'm desperate, and I want to know all the answers, and I don't want to talk to you, and I don't want to help you, and I don't want to give you a ride, and I don't want to put out chairs, and I don't want to pick up cigarette butts, and I don't want to, I look in the mirror, and I say, life is unfair, and I have a very bad day. I have a very bad sober day. But if I realize that the answer is not having any answers, the solution is in God's will and not my will, I have great days, you know, and they're easy and they're free, you know. And those days have allowed me to become a person that my friends don't even recognize. When I make these amends to my old friends, the ones that I can see because they're not crazy people, because a lot of my old friends are either drunk or in AA, you know, or dead. Absolutely, I have a lot of dead friends. And that's another reason why I stay here. I was speaking for a girl I sponsored. I am known to sponsor people from time to time when they let me. And I was sponsoring this one girl, and she decided that she wanted to dance at a bar. And I told her, I can't sponsor you when you're at a bar, but I was very angry about it. I almost left because I thought that if she wants to do that, she can do that. And if she drinks, well, then that's MFP for her, but I'll still help her. I'll go to any lengths to help another alcoholic. This is my rationale. I didn't think that it wasn't going to be safe for me. I didn't think about me. I was thinking about somebody else the whole time, but I was thinking about me. I was like collecting pigeons, you know. I was, or people, sponsees, or, you know, around where I grew up. I mean, I grew up in Midtown, really. In the last 5 years, I don't even know what's happened to me. But, again, I think that I'm running out of time. No, I got 10 minutes. Okay, so, 8-step, right? I write this 4-step, or the many 4 steps that I wrote. I do the 5th step, and we put stars by the people. Now, I don't really know what this means. When I first got sober, it was like a year sober when I did my first 4-step. And then we did another one about 6 months later, and more stars went by it. And I'm writing this list. I'm taking inventory of my shortcomings is what I think. It's like beat up Marissa Fest. But what I realized is that in 6 and 7, I'm really building this list as a list of experience that I can help the newcomer with. You know, I have this wealth of experience to help people. And if they come to me with a problem I can't help them with, if I'm honest about where I come from, and if my heart is open, I can find them a person or a way to get over what they're angry about. I am always getting people coming to me like, I can't stop being angry. I can't stop wanting to kill people. I can't stop wanting to throw, like, when I was new, my favorite saying was, I love the sound of breaking glass. And people related to that, you know? Some people related to that. I loved the sound of breaking. I loved it. We had this game when I hung out in Georgetown called Dodge Bottle, where we would stand on either side of the aqueducts and throw bottles at each other. And if you know, went like this, then you were out. And then by the end of the night, there was one bottle that wouldn't get broken. You got that bottle. And it was full, right. And that was our game. That was our way, you know. You know, only me, right? So, I mean, and I would just stand there, you know, and I would wait. I would wait for that bottle of SoCo every night, you know. It's like I just needed the sugar. I'm one of those people that gets really hyper when they get drunk. And then I pass out or black out, and it's just over, you know. So introduce the alternative substances, and I get to drink as much as I want. It's so exciting. And it really was. It was just like a whole new world opened up to me. And so another 10 years of drinking happened, you know. And And then, and I would smoke my in a pot so that I wouldn't get sick. And, because, I mean, it does do what they say it does, you know, and so you don't get sick. And that was like, whew. So another wealth of experience, you know, talk to people about, like, oh, you did that too, you know. And so in 6 and 7, I just got to forgive myself for all that stuff, you know. It's like in the Lord's Prayer where it says, forgive others as he would forgive you, or you would forgive them, or whatever it says. And but I believe that, you know. Don't know it all the time, but I believe that. It's that if I can't forgive myself, how in the world can I expect other people to forgive me? Because I'm still acting like the same asshole. Still looking in the mirror, judging myself and putting it on other people. I'm still a bully. You know, scaring people away so I get to isolate and then blame it on them so that I don't have to take any credit for my life or any responsibility for anything I do. You know, as long as it's your fault, I'm the martyr, you know. My friends call me Marmar, and they think it's because it's cute, but the name first came when I was in high school from my friends. They called me Martyr Marissa, Marmar for short, and Lori came up to me in Midtown one day, and she went, Marmar, and I went, oh, you know, because I knew they were on to me, you know, like I was like, oh my God, somebody told them, you know, but it's true till this day, you know, if I don't admit where I'm wrong, if I don't clean up my side of the street, if I don't tell somebody else where I came from, I get confused. And I think I know all the answers. Like I said, the solution is in not knowing. For example, this summer I got some news that the FBI finally went through all the evidence from that assault, because it was in a park in D.C., so that's FBI area, and there are no new answers. Nothing came up that we didn't know already, and I will never know, ever, ever know, unless I remember who tried to kill me that day. And I got upset, you know, how unfair. Because when I fell out of that tree, I'll tell you what, I made another deal with God, you know. Sometimes it's those foxhole prayers, sometimes it's barter. You know, I screamed up in the sky, fine, you know, and I decided to be an AA member based on one day you're going to tell me who did this to me in this park. Because I felt like it was all a result of him letting me live. And how dare he let me live? You know, and I felt like at times very invincible because of that, you know, like I can take anything, you know, like I have very stupid tattoos because of that. Some things that just were a good idea at the time. And but I mean, I really believed I was invincible. And now I know that I can be as long as I stay here. I mean, I have 350 people behind me. And AA is a very big place, and if I move somewhere else, I'll have a bunch of people behind me there, just as long as I'm a member, you know? And so I had to realize this summer that the solution for me is in not knowing, and that gives me a lot of freedom. That also gives me a very large, large God, because if I don't think I understand that, he can be as big as he needs to be to take care of my problem. And my mom passed away this February, and so she came to Midtown every Sunday, you know, every year that Sunday to see me pick up my chip, and she won't be able to do that this year. So, you know, I'm speaking a lot this month in her memory just so that I can feel like I have a purpose, and that she went to Al-Anon for a reason. You know, so she learned how to be tough and kick me out of her house when she needed to, because that's really what got me here, is that they just kicked me out of every house. I had nowhere else to go, and at the end of the day, I wouldn't rather be anywhere else. So thank you for letting me speak.